Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me here on the Biography Channel of the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. I'm your host, Dan Hill, and I'm joined today by Kevin Magruder. He is the author of Philip Payton, The Father of Black Harlem. The publisher is Columbia University Press. Kevin is an associate professor of history at Antioch College. He's also the author of Race and Real Estate, and in the 1990s was the director of real estate development for the Abyssinian Development Corporation, a nonprofit church-based organization in Harlem. Today's episode is The Man Who Branded Harlem. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So to begin, give us a brief overview of the book, if you will.
Sure. So Philip Payton, The Father of Black Harlem, describes the man who, between 1904 and 1917, marketed Harlem for Black people and helped to facilitate the movement of large numbers of Black people there. And so understanding what he did, I also wanted to understand why he did it and who he was. And so I go into a fair amount of background on his parents' backgrounds, work, the relationships that Philip Payton developed, particularly with Booker T. Washington, who at that time was viewed as the leader of Black Americans, and come to an understanding of the life that Philip Payton led and also the times, like what were the challenges and opportunities that were available to him at that time. And so I really look at all of those things in the book.
Okay, yeah, and I very much want to go into that context because there's a lot of interesting things happening in that era, and interesting is maybe a nice way to put some of them because they're pretty ominous at times. But let's go back, if we could, just speaking of context, your book, Race and Real Estate, anything that from that book that's pertinent and gives us a nice context, a launching point into this book, because surely from that and from your work in Harlem, for the Abyssinian Development Corporation, you come with unusually strong credentials for such a book as this one.
Yeah, the Race and Real Estate book, that came out in 2015, and it really explored the times. So I'm looking, in that book, I was looking at the period 1890 to 1920, and the subtitle of that is Conflict and Cooperation in Harlem, 1890 to 1920. And probably most of us are fairly familiar with racial conflict that happens in northern cities as larger numbers of Black people move there in the first decades of the 1900s. And so I look at that, but I also looked at cooperation between white residents of Harlem and Black newcomers. And that's something that we're less familiar with. And then I really wanted to understand why that was happening. And the key kind of thread to both books is real estate transactions. And so having an MBA in real estate finance, working as director of real estate development for a nonprofit organization, I became very familiar with in New York City, the organization that records real estate transactions is the City Register. In each of the five boroughs, each borough has a City Register's office. And there's a wealth of information from those real estate transactions that can be mined. And in this case, I really needed it because there's not personal papers of Philip Payton or business records. And so having that really allowed me to get a foundation on who was doing what, and also then using census records to and others to really try to shape, fill in the gaps in who these people were.
Okay, well, speaking of census numbers, there was some, you know, you gave context early in the book and you mentioned you grew up in Westfield, Massachusetts. I actually have a friend who teaches college there, so I know the town fairly well. But you mentioned a bit, going back into the father and so forth, North Carolina. There's some pretty shocking numbers from where the Confederacy was at in that state going into the war, because there was 331,000, you know, enslaved African Americans, only 34,000 slaveholders out of a white population of over 600,000. That is, if my math's right, about 6% of the white people were slaveholders, yet they seem to have dominated that economy. What's their equivalency in Harlem? Who are the big players that Philip finds himself up against?
The Harlem was developed as an urban community in the late 1800s, 1890s, 1880s, 1890s. And by the time Philip Payton is in New York, he moves there in 1899 and has dropped out of high school, and his prospects, if you looked at him on paper, didn't look that good. But one of the jobs that he gets, he loses his first job, but then gets a job with a man named Charles Schuyler, who was a major development of the Upper West Side. And Payton is working as a porter there. So it's a menial job, but he's an inquisitive person. He grew up, he comes from a family of entrepreneurs, both his parents. His father was a barber, his mother was a hairdresser. And so as he's in that office, he describes seeing the building of the Upper West Side. And Schuyler was a major figure in that. And Payton, in that, gets the idea to start a real estate agency. And his initial partner, Albert Brown, only stays with him for a year. But Payton stays with it. And by 1904, when he's moving out in a bigger way. And what precipitates that move is an organization called the Hudson Realty Company, which was made up of some of the leaders of the older families in New York, the Morgenthau family, the Bloomingdale family of the Bloomingdale department store. That firm had started in the 1890s. And by 1904, they're looking at land adjacent to where the Harlem one of the Harlem stops on the subway is going to be at 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. And the subway was scheduled to open in the fall of 1904. And in earlier in that year, in 1904, they begin buying up vacant land and occupied buildings in that 135th and Lenox Avenue area. And then in the spring, they serve eviction notices on the residents of the buildings. And a fair amount of the residents are Black. And typically, probably Black residents would have just left quietly. But that area had been, it's really three blocks, 134th, 133rd, 135th Street between Lenox and Fifth Avenue. Black people had been living there since the 1890s. And so they were firmly established in their eyes. And so they challenged that. And I haven't been able to figure out if they actually end up being evicted. But what I do know is Payton and a handful of other Black investors begin buying property, and they buy it from white property owners, mainly German Americans, who are not in alignment with the hostility against Black people that Hudson's efforts represent. And that's what really launches Philip Payton in the public eye, citywide at least, and then soon nationally, is that conflict, because it's like a chess game that Hudson Realty had bought property trying to assemble a large expanse. And Payton and his colleagues' purchases block that. And by the end of the year, Hudson Realty sells their properties. And by the summer of 1904, Payton announces the incorporation of the Afro-American Realty Company, with a flourish in terms of publicity, a prospectus, and a vision of what was then called a race enterprise. It would be a company, what we would call now for us and by us. It's the 1904 equivalent to that. And it very much fits with the thinking of some African Americans in terms of self-determination. And by this time, he is already in Booker T. Washington's inner circle. And when he is successful in these purchases, Booker T. Washington, who spends a lot of time in New York, sends him a congratulatory telegram saying, "You have triumphed both in terms of real estate and for the race." And so that effort of his is framed as a race enterprise, as something that's going to benefit Black people.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty heady start. And the audaciousness of this is quite amazing. I mean, he's very young.
Right.
And he's up against, he's 28 years old. He's up against, deep pockets, to say the least, given the kind of, pedigree that the Hudson Realty Company has. Where did he, you raised this, where did he, in fact, find this drive? Yes, his parents are entrepreneurs, but they're in Westfield. He's taking on New York City. That's quite a step up.
I think it's a combination of things. Something that I think often we don't understand now is that Black people's expectations at that time, many Black people's expectations was that with hard work, they would be able to live the American dream. And they really did not see what we now, looking back, we can see not just segregation that they might have lived through in the late 1800s, but how it's going to grow in the teens and increase in some ways. And so there's an optimism that a lot of them have. And that's really why Booker T. Washington is so important, because he was one of the promoters of that optimistic view. And so some people assume that Black men like Peyton were naive. And I think what they don't understand is that so Black people at that time often were being told, you don't have equal rights because you haven't prospered enough. And so they felt with prosperity, they met that criteria and they would have their rights.
Yeah.
And so that's one. And then personally, there's some elements of sibling rivalry that are going on. Peyton had an older sister. She goes to Westfield Normal school, a teaching college, which is now Westfield State, while he has dropped out of school and is working in his father's barbershop. And the year that he decides to move to New York, 1899, his brother, who is James, who is a year younger than him, is about to graduate from Yale with a degree in classics. And he even implies that his parents really wanted better for him than working in a barbershop. A barbershop was a very good career for Black men at the time, but his parents, mother and father, his mother was a hairdresser. It's like most parents, they want their children to go to the next level. And so there's that drive. And then the fact that his brother is at Yale, all of those things seem to propel him to move to New York. And he even talks about if he didn't do it then, he didn't know when he was going to do it. And so he's 23 when he moves. Then when he gets there, what we see is his ingenuity and promotion. And some of that, there's evidence of it even earlier. So he did drop out of school, but he fashioned a graduation picture that I have in the book. And I don't know how he used it, but he definitely understood the power of an image. And that's what he begins to do in New York. We don't know exactly how he gets to work in Schuyler's office. But Westfield, there was a tie between good students in Westfield going to Yale. So that's how his brothers get there, but others do as well. Schuyler went to Yale, didn't graduate, but went to Yale. And so there's probably a connection there that opens that door. And so some of it's that. And some of it I haven't been able to answer. He you know, there are some people who have that kind of drive that no matter what setback happens, they believe they can rise to the occasion. And that's really what he was doing for really the rest of his life. He was kind of having challenges, but then regrouping and coming back.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, no, you know, for instance, that the prospectus he put out is, you know, very nicely done. Mm-hmm. And he's intent on making a splash. So you mentioned context, and I want to go to a couple of things that happened in the same time frame. So, you know, it's 1904 that he launches the Afro-American Realty Company. It is merely 1 year before that Dubois comes out with his famous book, The Souls of Black Folk. Mm-hmm. It's merely 1 year after that, unfortunately, that Thomas Dixon comes out with The Klansman.
Right.
There's a lot of things happening at the start of the 21st century. Do you want to just walk us through that a bit more?
Sure. I think that a very strong factor in Peyton kind of coming to blackness was a year that he spent going to Livingston College, the high school branch of it. He was in high school. He was hanging out with the wrong crowd, and his father wants to get him out of Westfield and sends him to Livingstone. His father was friends with the president, a man named J.C. Price. Price was really the founding president of Livingstone. It's a college of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in Salisbury, North Carolina. W.E.B. Du Bois described J.C. Price as building a Harvard of the South. And so there's that dynamic leader. Price dies soon after Peyton gets there. But Peyton spends that year at what we now call a historically black college. Westfield had a very small black population. So this is really the first time that Peyton is living among predominantly black people. And there is a parallel to Du Bois. Du Bois went to Fisk from Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He's a little bit older than Peyton, but it's that experience that leads him to write The Souls of Black Folk, that he didn't grow up around a lot of black people, but now he's ensconced among blackness. And The Souls of Black Folk is a celebration of that. And so Peyton comes to that in the same way. Peyton was a Booker T. Washington follower. I don't have evidence that he was part of the Niagara movement, which Du Bois forms later. But Peyton, there were some people who had feet in both camps of Du Bois and of Washington. I don't have evidence that Peyton was in both camps, but some of the things he does, and actually even his confrontational nature with the white power structure, that really is not the strategy that Booker T. Washington recommended.
Exactly, yes.
But it's fascinating because he doesn't get cast out as he does it, that he stays within Booker T. Washington's fold, even as some of the things he does, I think from a strategic point of view, create the backlash that he experiences later. And the actions that he takes are really more in alignment with what you would expect a follower of Du Bois to do. And so there's all of those influences, and he's kind of navigating them during that time. And what he's also navigating is the growing segregation in New York City. that it's not to say that New York was a utopia before, but there were segregation practices that were relatively somewhat porous. But as larger numbers of Black people moved there, they hardened. And in the Race and Real Estate book, I talk about Booker T. Washington's assistant, Emmett Scott, who traveled to New York a lot too. And there's a letter where Emmett Scott is writing to the hotels in New York, finding a place where he can stay, where 5 or 10 years before, he could stay at any place downtown. And this is probably the teens by that time. And he's getting replies, there's no place you can stay here. And that's the change. And if I have my numbers right, I think it's during the time when Woodrow Wilson becomes president. Woodrow Wilson segregates the Federal Employment Service, which was not segregated before. And his presidency brings in a wave of kind of hardened segregation practices that is in alignment with what's happening in northern cities. And so in some ways, Peyton needed to rise to the resistance that he was seeing. And so it's not just gratuitous confrontation that he has in some cases. If he didn't, he might have been blocked totally and he wouldn't have a business then.
Yeah, no, the ties are definitely shifting a bit. And for anyone who, of course, thinks that Woodrow Wilson's this benign former president of Princeton University, yeah, there's a lot more going on, unfortunately, with Woodrow Wilson's administration.
And you also mentioned Thomas Dixon. Peyton is on that radar. In the book, I talk about they try to kind of bait him into
goad him into
speaking out against the Klansman play when that's going to be in New York. And he doesn't take the bait in that way. And so he understands media as much as Dixon does. And so, you know, he's a worthy opponent in that case.
Yeah, but it seems to me you're going back to the Livingston College, you know, that dynamic leader that was at that college does seem to be part of his style and part of his daring. But yes, the vice is closing in some ways.
Right.
You have a really important term in the book, racial capitalism. It seems to me we would be amiss to get out of this interview without bringing that up. Mm-hmm. What does it mean and what's its significance in the context of this book?
I was an economics major in college and I went to Harvard. And sometimes I call it the Vatican of capitalism. you know, when you look at the size of its endowment.
Sure.
But there's this way that we think of capitalism as this neutral system that runs according to natural laws. And it incorporates all the elements of racism that our country has had from the beginning. And so the conversation that's going on now that's being, you know, kind of distorted, a distortion of critical race theory is really touches on that what racial capitalism means is that in Peyton's situation, a Black businessman forming a business has to navigate the ways that race has been incorporated in the industry that they are in. And so if you look at real estate, first, capital, you need capital to do something. And the reason why those German Americans are really important for Peyton is because to finance a apartment building purchase in 1904, those apartments were considered risky. So you didn't just go to a bank. Typically, it might be an estate that you borrowed from. In Peyton's case, he's able to borrow from the seller, that they take back a mortgage for that. And there's not a racial aspect to that situation. But if you're a Black person in 1904, and you don't understand that you don't have the same access to capital, or even to those lenders, then you're going to be at a disadvantage. And so Peyton, so he is navigating that. What also is part of this is, so the Morgenthaus, the Bloomingdales, that is multi-generational wealth that gives them power to enter the field. Peyton's family were entrepreneurs. They owned a building in Westfield. In terms relative to other Black people, they were relatively well off, but I don't have any evidence that they had the kind of capital that would allow him to move forward with their investment. And so he's really on his own in doing this. And that's how most Black entrepreneurs of the time are. And so they're working at a disadvantage and they know it. And that's why when he forms that company, he has about a dozen Black entrepreneurs. Most of them are older than him, but there's no way he could do this company by himself. Whereas Hudson has fewer partners because each of them are bringing a lot of money.
Lots of assets.
And so he's not doing that. And then the overlay in terms of real estate is this is a period where there's a book called The Kind of Nation of Blackness by Khalil Muhammad, who is a former director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. He's now a professor at Harvard Kennedy School. But he looks at the late 1800s in terms of crime, and he uses this phrase, this is the period where race is being written into crime. The period that Peyton is active, that those first decades of the 1900s, is the period where race is being written into real estate. Because what's happening is the notion that the presence of Black people alone, no matter what their economic status, lowers property values, that's being written into real estate practices. The real estate industry professionalizes during this period. And when they do, this is after Peyton's death in the 20s, when the National Association of Realtors writes their code of ethics, they write into it that you cannot introduce a Black person into a predominantly white neighborhood. Black people can't even use the term realtors.
That was amazing when I read that in the book.
And so those practices don't come out of nowhere. They're being developed during Peyton's life. And so that's what I mean by racial capitalism, is that there's a way that race, it dictates the environment that he is operating in. And if he ignored that, he wouldn't have been able to survive at all.
Okay. So we did mention, you've alluded to earlier that, not everything turned out as Peyton promised in his prospectus, and some of his, certainly the forces he faced. But going back to that prospectus, if I remember right, it promises investors, and he's eager to cobble together what he can because he's up against the powers that be, that the returns might be in the range of 7% to 10%. It seems like from the book and your recounting, there was a struggle to get close to that. He did face a lawsuit. I mean, as he goes through all these different issues and trying to make it work, do you think Booker T. Washington was aware of the struggles that Peyton had and just kind of turned a blind eye? He didn't have the time to pay attention. He realized, that Peyton had a tough hand to play. Any sense or any trajectory you can give us of both what happened for Peyton and how Booker T. Washington might have seen the unfolding of this?
Booker T. Washington, I believe, knew very well what was happening because Emmett Scott, his right-hand man, was an officer of the company. He knew. But another reason why I know that is that Peyton and his wife, Maggie, entertained regularly at their home on 131st Street between Lenox and Fifth Avenue in Harlem. And often the guest list was in the New York Age, which was the Black paper of record at the time. And often the guest was Booker T. Washington. So he was in their home. And even when Peyton is having struggles, Washington is in the circle, doesn't cast him out. Washington dies in 1915. And to the end, Peyton is part of that circle. So I'm sure that Washington might have been disappointed by some of the setbacks Peyton experienced. But if you think about Washington's philosophy, you have setbacks and then you work and move forward. That's what Peyton was doing. And so I don't have any evidence that that there was any break with Washington, and both because of Emmett Scott's relationship, and but also Peyton had a direct relationship with Washington.
Sure. Peyton only lives two more years after Washington's
death. Right. In that perspective, he did oversell that the standard return for real estate during that time was 6%. And as soon as I saw that 7 to 10%, it's like, well, how's he going to do that? and he couldn't. And that's part of the reason for the lawsuit. But that lawsuit is very fishy. that the person representing the plaintiffs is his attorney, who was one of his officers, who wrote the prospectus. But the suit claims that the prospectus was fraudulent. And so the attorney, and that comes out in court, that the attorney is the one who wrote it. So I haven't been able to figure out everything that's behind that. But it's a strange suit. But Peyton did overpromise some of the things that were in it.
Sure. Well, when I read the 7 to 10%, my mind flashed to Bernie Madoff, because I just thought, well, that's a pretty healthy return that you're promising year in, year out. Bring us up to date.
There's no signs of a shell game here, though.
No, there's not.
Scheme, though, but
he did not end up in prison. He did not bilk a bunch of people out of their life savings, including nonprofits. As Bernie Madoff did. In fact, the name Bernie Madoff, he made off with everyone else's money. Is almost one of these too good to be true jokes.
Exactly.
Let's finally bring us up to date. So, you know, you've worked in Harlem in the real estate arena. Mm-hmm. Where does the community stand today? Any kind of closing thoughts you might have on that front?
The future that James Weldon Johnson predicted in Black Manhattan, which he wrote in 1930, is really coming about. He was asking, how long will Black people be able to hold on to Harlem? I was there last week, and, you know, there is a substantial number of Black people in Harlem on the streets. There's some large residential buildings being built in and completed in various areas that, you know, I suspect are predominantly not Black people living there. And so there are changes happening at this point. And, you know, so some of them, those changes are the legacy of kind of the racial capitalism that we were talking about, that, but some represent opportunities that Black people who owned buildings were able to do very well with the increase in property values. I owned an apartment that I bought in 1987, a co-op apartment, and sold it 2 years ago. And so I know, you know, kind of what the appreciation was, at least, you know, for me and for others. And so there's this kind of double-edged sword to the changes that have happened in Harlem.
Okay. In fact, yes, I have a closing epigram in a moment that kind of speaks to the ongoing difficulties and struggles and government role in some of this. So I want to thank you, Kevin, very much for being on the show. This is the New Books Network's Biography Channel. My guest has been Kevin Magruder. He is the author of Philip Peyton, The Father of Black Harlem. If you enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can check out other episodes in the Biography Channel by going to the New Books Network platform itself. Finally, a concluding epigram. In this case, I'm quoting from Charles Abram, who says, "The government has offered such bounties to builders and lenders that they could have required compliance with a non-discrimination policy. Instead, the FHA adopted a racial policy that could well have been called for the Nuremberg laws." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.